Please help me welcome our speaker tonight, my good friend, Steve Calder Banks from Perfect Me.
It's not the introduction I paid for. Hi, everybody. I'm an alcoholic. My name's Steve.
Hey, Steve.
And I am grateful and glad to be here with you folks tonight on the final night outdoors. I do think it would be a testament of our willingness to go to any lengths to be sitting out here in February, but I guess the group conscience has spoken, and they're going to be indoors after tonight. I'd be remiss in my AA 101 duties. AA 101 is how to speak in an AA meeting. We tell what it was like, what happened, and what it's like now. And I like to try to summarize my drinking. You know, as I'll tell you, I got sober at the age of 22, and alcohol alone was not part of my bottom. There was a couple of other things, potato chips and some other stuff that played a big part in me finding the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. But what I should do is talk about the last year of my drinking. The last year of my drinking, well, I can summarize it from going from my third DWI. I got my third DWI in February of 1989, and you know, I had what I thought was a spiritual awakening as they put the handcuffs on me. Said, "Wow, I'm really not doing too good here. I'm probably making some mistakes with my life, and I probably need to make some changes." Well, you know, I did the 48 hours of in the city lockup. It was in Baltimore City at the Guilford Street Station. It's right down the street from a great meeting at a place called the Chip House. And I'd been there many times before then. I'd been in and out of Alcoholics Anonymous since 1983. Three DWIs in Maryland, they send you to AA over and over again. So I get out, 48 hours in jail. I'm going to move back to my mom's house. And that's going to fix things. I'm going to change because I'm living on the streets in Baltimore, and I'm living in a warehouse, and a guy with a bobby pin in his face and a mohawk that he used paint and shellac to keep it looking cool was telling me I've got problems. And, you know, so I was like, all right, I need to get away from these people. I'm going to move back home to my mom's house. And me and my mom had a little ritual. You know, I'd get in trouble, and I would move home, and my mom would say, "This is the last time you're doing this. I can't stand watching you live like this. You're killing me." And then she'd hug me, bring me in, put me to bed, feed me, do my laundry, and within a matter of days, weeks, never more than a month, I would be out and running around again. So I'm not distracted by that in the least. I'm just saying, I'm not. I'm just twitchy. So, you know, mom brings me in, and that's the cycle. I last a couple weeks, and I go out on a run, and then I last a couple days, and I go out on a run. And this is my life. This is my normal, in the doctor's opinion. It talks about the alcoholic life seems the only normal one. That's what I did. I didn't know how to live without drinking, because when you take booze out of me, I just become a mess. Like, my problems, all the problems that, you know, intellectually I knew at that time, you know, being sober at like two or three AA meetings or being coherent enough at a couple of AA meetings, I started to get the idea that when I drank the first drink, I was going to get drunk. I got it. Locked on. I'm not a dummy. I get it. When I pick up the first one, it's how do I not pick up the first drink? That was the problem. You know, and when folks said, "Hey, if you don't pick up the first drink, you won't get drunk," like, okay, Captain Obvious, I get that part. But you don't understand. I'm going to. Well, you just don't want it enough, kid. And I bought that. I was like, maybe they're right, you know. And so I'm facing this third DWI, and I violated probation on that thing. So I'm in trouble. But it's 1989. Things were a little different. You know, my lawyer called me up, and he gave me the devil's kiss a couple nights before going to court. He said, "Look," he said, "your mom tells me you've been doing good for a couple days, and then you go out and get stupid. He's like, you're going to court in a couple days. This is what's going to happen. You're going to go in there. You're going to lose your driver's license. You're going to pay a fine. You're going to do community service. Then you're going to walk. All you need to do is not screw up. He didn't say that. He used other stronger language. But we're on tape, and I have to pretend I'm, you know, socially acceptable. And that was like the kiss of death, because the night before going to court, the phone rings. In 1989, we didn't have cell phones. You know, phone rings, all I got to do is not answer it. I have no business answering a phone in my mom's house. You know, nobody knows I'm here. I answer the phone. Somebody knows I'm there. Hey, what are you doing, man? I don't know. What are you doing? I'm bored. Well, let's go out for a little bit. All right, sure. No intention of picking up. No intention. Every intention of being home by 11. I got to be at court at 8 o'clock in the morning. I know this when I walk out. But several days later, when I came out of a blackout and realized I missed going to court, the first thing I did was reach for the bottle and continue drinking, because that's how I solve problems. Sure, I know it creates them, but it sure solves them too. Oblivion, I don't have to deal with anything. You know, so that was my life. And I'm out on the streets, running around, avoiding a bench warrant. And, you know, my mom was from the 50s version of Kensington, not the Kensington of today. She was from the 50s version of Kensington. They were still badass, but it wasn't as bad as it is today. But my mom was a tough old lady. And, you know, she talked me off the ledge, talked me into turning myself in, and, you know, talked me into doing the right thing. And I did. I went in, I listened to mom, and I went in, I turned myself in, and I got locked up. And while I'm locked up, I got time to think. And I'm like, I've really made a mess of my life. This stuff has taken me off the street. This stuff has taken away my liberty, my freedom. I have no say in what happens to me right now. I'm powerless because I keep picking up. I keep drinking. I keep doing all this crap. And I have no control of my own life because of that. And I was, you know, that whole, like, guy with the mohawk, punk rocker dude, I was all into this vision of freedom that meant, like, no responsibility and don't do anything. I called it freedom. You might have called it freeloading. But that was my version of life. That's who I thought I was. You know, so here I am. I'm stuck. I'm locked up. And it sucks, you know. And being incarcerated for a day sucks. You know, so I get out. And it's the first time in my life I'm not trying to win back a girlfriend. I'm not trying to get into mom's house. I'm not trying to get a boss to stop firing me. I want to stop drinking for good and all. But I don't want to hang out with you corny-ass people that say stupid slogans and nod your head north and south at every dumb thing that's ever said. I had you guys all figured out. You know, I had you guys all figured out now. Unfortunately, some of you guys were doing some overtime on me. You know, because between 83 and 89 when I got sober, all through that time I'd run into you guys and nothing you said in a meeting ever got through. Nothing anybody ever said in the meeting. I mean, I get it. The don't drink the first drink, you won't get drunk. I get it. Nothing about your recovery program ever sunk through. You know, but what you did the other 23 hours of the day spoke volumes. You know, there's a saying that goes around, you know, carry the message, speak when necessary. And a lot of you were carrying the message without even using words. So I can remember, you know, I tell a lot of people, my car broke down one night. I had that kind of car, you know, that it found guardrails, telephone poles, and it does a lot of damage, you know. And I'm on the side of the road. My crew goes rolling on by. They see me, and they're like, yo, Stevie! And everybody just keeps rolling on down the road. It's November. It's raining. It's cold, and I'm on the side of the road in no condition to be driving or no condition to be on the side of the road. You know, somebody from one of the meetings that I was court ordered to go pulls up behind me, helps me take a look at my car, realizes, like, yeah, we ain't going to get this started tonight. It's starting to come down. Why don't you get in the truck? I'll give you a lift home. You know, gave me a ride home. The next day, I don't remember none of this because I'm that guy. Like, I drink and I don't have blackouts. I just forget real easy. And the door knocks. It's noon. Who's knocking on my door at noon? It's too damn early. I go downstairs, and I'm like, who are you? And he's like, come on, let's go get your car, man. That's the kind of crap you guys did to me, man. And it screwed me up because I wanted to hate you guys. Because my very first AA meeting was a train wreck from hell. And I won't even get into it. But I had you guys figured out in 83 when I came to my first meeting. And if anybody believes there's never been a bad meeting, I started a few. I've been the cause of two or three bad meetings, and I was at a few. Most of them aren't, but occasionally we can screw up even an AA meeting. It's pretty hard to do, but a couple of us have managed to do it. So I get out of jail, and I'm like, yeah, I'm not doing this anymore. I'm done. 5 days later, I'm banging my head against the wall going, how do I keep doing this? Why does this keep happening to me? What is my problem? I know I can't do it. I know it's going to happen. I'm driving without a license. Einstein, driving without a license, intoxicated for the same thing that put me behind bars, So I wake up one morning, and I don't know how honest I was. No, I really don't know. I wake up in the morning, and I'm laying in the back of my truck, and I'm just, God, I don't want to live like this anymore. Probably the most honest prayer I ever said. I ended up that night back at my mom's house because she had told me to get the hell out of there again. And, she's, Stephen, you're killing me. I can't watch you do this. The same deal over and over again. Hugs me, kisses me, brings me in, feeds me chicken, does my laundry, puts me to bed. That night I go to a meeting. I went to a meeting called Emerton Beginners. Or it was at Emerton Monday night in Maryland. And the beginners meeting hadn't started yet. And they invited me back. They said, hey, we're glad to see you back. And I sat through the meeting. And no, I didn't get a desire chip. No, I didn't want anybody shaking my hand. A couple guys that had recognized me coming in and out of the rooms, talked to me after the meeting. Everybody knew where I lived because a bunch of them had, found me wandering the roads a time or two, and a few of them had given me rides here and there. And, so my journey began. I said, well, what do I do now? He said, well, get a sponsor. I didn't even ask. They didn't offer what one was. I was like, okay. So I asked some guy, will you be my sponsor? He said, sure. I said, well, what do we do? He said, I don't know. Don't drink. And I'm like, well, let me explain something to you, dude. Maybe I'm unique in this area, but I don't know how to not drink. That's kind of why I'm here. And he said, well, just don't drink. Come back tomorrow and tell me how you did it. I was like, I don't know if I'm going to make it till tomorrow. And I was scared. I was really freaking scared. And when you guys said things like, just don't drink, and if that helped you, I really don't mean it in a derogatory manner. I should have given my disclaimer at first. I usually do. If anything I say aggravates you or makes you angry, I do apologize. I don't intend it. I was born under a bridge with the AM radio on, and I'm full of a lot of static. I'm working on it. I'm trying to get better, but I got a lot of stuff going on that doesn't come out the way I intend it to, but I'm trying. When you guys said just don't drink, I thought, great, here's one more thing I'm going to fail at. I didn't blame you. I blamed me. I was like, this is one more thing I'm not going to get. These people are sober. They're miserable looking, but they're sober. Ain't none of them happy, And so I went on. I fired him because somebody told me, one of the old heads said, hey, kid, you can fire your sponsor if you don't like him. I'm like, I could do that? Oh, that's freaking great, So you're fired. And I asked, I went back to the old head, and I said, hey, what do I do? How do I get a sponsor? What is a sponsor? And he said, well, look for somebody who's got the spiritual program. And once again, I'm like, I don't know what the hell you're talking about, but I'm just nodding my head, and okay. So I go ask this other guy to be my sponsor, and he, had all these flowery things to say, like, just let go, absolutely. And I'm looking at my hands like, what am I holding on to, dude? I'm like, I'm not that bright. I know this. I don't know what you're talking about. And he would say things like, just exhale. That's dumb. Of course I'm going to exhale. I do that in my sleep. And the point I'm getting at is he never gave me anything substantial. You know, he just kept saying stuff at me. Like I would say, dude, I'm freaking out here. I'm really afraid I'm going to drink because I can't stand this way I feel. I'm nuts. I mean, I'm watching people get up and say, oh, I have 30 days sober and I feel great. I'm like, you're a liar. There's no way you feel good. I can't be the only one. Because that's how I always felt when I was in meetings. And I always felt like the table got really long and I was getting moved further and further away from you guys. And, you know, once I was 22 and you guys would say, oh, you're so brave, you're so strong, and you're so one. And the room got a lot bigger and you got further away. Because that's really, you were buying me a drink when you told me that. You were separating me from you because we're all supposed to be equal here. We're all supposed to be the same. We're all supposed to be a drunk helping another drunk. There's not a special kind of drunk. Just because God brought me in here at the age of 22, because I would turn it around on, like when the old heads would say that to me, I'd be like, well, look, you need to say that. You probably see Jesus every night, don't you? Because if I do this thing, I'm going to have to like be around here for a while. And at the time, like a life of sobriety at the age of 22 really sounded like just lobotomized me now. You know, I knew I couldn't drink and I knew what I was doing sucked. This didn't really seem like a great alternative. Going to your bowling tournaments and hanging out at Friendly's, that's what we did in Maryland, we hung out at Friendly's, just really didn't seem like a great idea, you know. So I'm 60 days sober. I run into a guy that I ran the streets with. And that was like my oasis. It's like, oh, my God, somebody that really gets me. And I grabbed him and I said, what do you do? And he's, you know, it's like, well, I'm working the steps and I got a sponsor and I'm trying to get myself together. And I was like, all right, well, how do you do that? Will you be my sponsor? And he's like, I can't. I can't, Stephen. And like, I just felt like I got kicked in the chest. And I felt like this is the night that it's just going to happen. I'm just going to surrender and accept the fact that I'm going to die of this disease. And then he threw me a lifeline. He said, I'll help you find somebody, though, that can work with you. And my friend JD introduced me to a guy named Jack down in Baltimore. And he walked me up to him. I felt like a kid at his first dance. You know, it was really creepy. He's like, he's touching me, first of all, which wasn't really okay at the time. I liked him. He was my buddy, but boundaries. You know, he puts his hand on my back and he's like, hey, I got somebody I want you to meet. He walks me right up to him. He says, Steve, this is Jack. Jack has what you need. And he walked away. But you know what? I trusted my friend. Because, you know, recovery, you know, I don't need you to teach me how to work the steps. I don't need a teacher. And I know that goes against what some of you say. Remember the disclaimer. I had the disclaimer out there. I put it out there. I don't need you to teach. I need you to share with me what you did. That's what I need you to do. You know, and at that time, that man Jack did exactly that. And what he first did, and what a lot of folks had done, was great 12-step work. A lot of you had done great 12-step work, and that's why I got the first step. I didn't intellectually get the first step. You shared your story with me. You shared what happened to you. And then you shared what the steps did to you, and you gave me hope. And that was enough of a door cracking open for me to walk through and get the second step. You know, I came to believe that there was something here that would work for me. How much more do I need to know at that point? I'm dying out there, and I'm scared that I'm going back. I don't want to go drink. I'm afraid that I'm going to end up resigning myself to drinking myself to death because I don't know what to do. I'm stuck in that restless, irritable, and discontent. You know, the doctor's opinion, it describes me to a T. You remove alcohol, restless, irritable, and discontent. Well, my sponsor, Jack, starts talking to me, and he's asking me about me. You know, he's not really telling me what to do yet, which I'm a little frustrated about that. I'm like, you know, when are you going to give me an assignment or something? And he's asking me questions about me, and he's talking about me. We're talking about my life and my stuff. And what he starts doing, now he was a used car salesman too, so he was used to peddling damaged goods. You know, so he was a good little shyster. he starts putting chapter 5, the chapter how it works, he starts putting that into language from my life. And he starts talking about, instead of saying, yeah, you're like the actor who sets the stage, he says, you know, Steve, you're the guy that tries to become the person that everybody around you wants you to be. And then he said some hurtful things that I'm not going to repeat because they're just not very nice. And basically he told me I was a untruthful person, you know. And I didn't really like that, but I stood and listened because it was true. And he also then he said, you know what? He said, I can see it because I am too. I was like, oh, okay, good. You ain't judging me. You're down there with me. You're not standing up above me like the people in church. You know, and he said, I am too, Steve. And he said, and this is what I did. And he started talking about that decision that he made to follow through with this program. And he told me, he said, you know, well, what he did was he broke it down in language I could understand. He knew I'm a musician. At the time I was playing in a band and I was on hiatus. I was on sabbatical because I wasn't going around people, places, and things, and I wasn't too happy about it. But he said to me, he said, Steve, if I gave you a brand new guitar tomorrow and you put it in your closet and you didn't play that guitar for an entire year and then you pulled it out, every now and then maybe you pull it out to show your buddies, to talk about it, he said, but you don't do anything with it. And then a year from now, you pull that guitar out, are you going to be able to rock out on it? I said, probably not. Probably going to be a little rust, going to be out of tune. I said, the calluses on my fingers aren't going to be, ready for it. I'm probably, my fingers aren't going to be used to it. He's like, that's right. He's like, because you made a decision to just put it aside. And I went, oh, so now he's going to try to get me to drink the Kool-Aid. And he started talking about what happened before he made that decision. And he said, you know, I was stuck, Steve. And he was 26 when he got sober, and he was about 35 at the time. And he said, you know, I was stuck. He's like, here I am, I'm sober, and I'm miserable, and my life absolutely sucks. He said, I made a decision. And I went on and I did that fourth step. And he said, you know what? And it didn't feel any better. And then he talked about instant gratification. And we got into a little sidebar about instant gratification. And then he reminded me, he's like, you know what? If you make the decision to follow this path, you can say goodbye to instant gratification. You're not getting it anymore. Shots of whiskey aren't the trick anymore. They're not the answer. He's like, but we have something infinitely greater than that instant gratification. He said, but we have to open ourselves up to this God's plan that you've said you're open to experiencing. So we went through, and he talked about his fifth step, and then he talked about making a couple of his amends. And, you know, I hear a lot of folks say, I sponsor exactly the way my sponsor sponsored me, and I don't. And I sit in the back room, in the back row of meetings, so I do a lot of bad stuff. So maybe I'm a bad example, but I don't. My first gentleman, Jack, who was all about the big book at that time, and where I got sober, I'm blessed that he crossed my path. Because where I got sober, it was unheard of to do a four-step before you had a year. And there was a lot of bad information given to me in the fellowship. And I'm not, some folks think I'm a fellowship basher, and I absolutely am not. I only have my experience. I was taught in the Baltimore area, it was, if you raise your hand, that's your ego talking. Well, what if you're dying? You know, but I bought into it. I went, okay, give me that Kool-Aid. And I drank it up. And it was actually easy for me because I didn't want to talk to any of yous anyway. You know, and this gentleman sponsored me for about a year and a half. He moved away, and I was into my ninth step. I was balking at a lot of things. You know, I was experiencing that wonderful state of stark raving sobriety where you're physically sober and you've experienced the relief. You've experienced, you've had spiritual experiences. You've felt God touch your heart. And then you say, yeah, I'm good now. I'm just going to chill. I'm just taking a break. Has everything got to be AA all the time? Damn. Anybody feel that way ever? Because I did. And I went back and forth with that for quite a few years in my sobriety. I ended up moving away from Baltimore, and I went to Texas. And everybody, you know, once again, the fellowship, what I look at today is even when people are saying, like, things that maybe don't sound too healthy, I got to remember, we all love each other. You know, at the end of the day, that's what I always have to remember. Even when we're saying crap that might sound like that doesn't line up to the big book. And that's, I became a big book militant, fascist, if you will. And you know, I know the book. I can quote the book. I know what it says on what page and that. And I know all that. I had a hard time experiencing it because I was busy having an intellectual experience with some things. I was having genuine spiritual experiences, but I was getting caught up in a lot of the black and white. And when the fellowship told me, you know, Steve, you can't move to Texas. You're too sick. You're going to get drunk. I said, no, I'm not. I've got God. And, you know, the fellowship said, that's not going to happen, Steve. You're going to go down there and you're going to get drunk. And I didn't get drunk, but I sure as heck got crazy-er. Because as much as I, at that time, I was 5 years sober, and I was really getting sick of the fellowship telling me what to do. They meant well, once again, and maybe if you guys that are younger, maybe you're experiencing that. A lot of folks, I think a lot of the AA folks that like lost their kids start to want to adopt us. I'm not one of you anymore. I was once. And a lot of folks would try to be really paternalistic with me, and it always kind of aggravated the heck out of me. And so I kind of rebelled at a lot of that, like just like a teenager that I did with my mom. So I got to relive my teenage years all over again in early AA. But what I learned in Texas was I needed the fellowship as much as I needed to have a relationship with my God. Because if I didn't have a relationship with the fellowship, my relationship with my God was theoretical at best. I could pray all day long. My father was a devoutly religious man. He died of this disease in a hotel, and nobody found him for several days. That's how the men in my family die. We die alone, drunk, face down, and drown in our own puke. I don't want to go out like that. I don't want to live a life like that. So when I went to Texas, you know, I didn't relate. I didn't like the things they said. Everybody was very pro-Jesus, and I was on this anti-religion thing at the time, and I rebelled against it, but at the same time, I knew that I needed it. But I was walking away from the fellowship for quite a number, I would drift away, for about 7 years. I stayed sober. I went to college. I had children. And you know when they tell you, like, getting into a relationship in recovery might make you a little bit crazy? Try procreating. Because, you know, love is just as much of a dangerous emotion as anger and rage. It's a powerful emotion. And you know, when my daughter was born, you know, April 30th, 1995, I was in military training. I joined the Navy, which is why I left Baltimore. And I was in a military training school for my rate training. And I moved my family down there with me because we knew, you know, it was going to happen soon. And when my daughter was born, I never experienced that much love in my life. I never experienced that much awe and amazement at the wonder of life. But also, having my history, I counted her fingers and toes a lot, you know. And I wanted to make sure. I'm like, oh, my God, I hope I don't have a crack baby. You know, I was worried about my child being born with this disease and all the neurosis that an over-loving parent can inflict upon a child. And I say inflict on purpose because I was going to love this kid to death. And I certainly did. And we had another one. And it was the same experience when my son was born. Powerful emotions. And I went, oh, my God, I have a family. I got to really get my crap together. I can't afford to spend all my time with you people. And you guys were still you people. A couple of yous were awesome. A couple of yous were lifesavers. A couple of yous were godsends. The other 99% of you, I didn't want you coming over to my house for poker night. You know, I knew I needed you, but I didn't want to be around you. And the problem's me. It ain't you. My default mode is mind your own business. That's my default. If I could have my own way, I would probably just be left alone. But in that third step, I made that decision to turn my will and my life over to the care of God. Decisions, decisions, decisions. That's a serious decision. And I remember back in Baltimore, when people say, no major decisions in your first year, my sponsor would lean over and he would say, what's the third step but the biggest decision you'll ever make? And what he was doing, he wasn't bad-mouthing the fellowship. He was making me bounce what you said off the book, because I love what you got to say. But I want to make sure it's validated by that book. Because even though I try not to be like a militant, black and white, big book slayer, I also realize that on page 18, we do a little big book reading at the Hope House on Thursday nights, and one of the first things I did was put those guys on page 18, and I asked them, I said, did you meet this person? And, that the man who's making the approach has had the same difficulty, that he has no holier-than-thou attitude, nothing but a sincere desire to be helpful. It describes a recovered alcoholic. It describes, it's our job description, if you will. Page 18 of the big book, and the top of page 19. It describes what we should be, and I asked him, I said, have you met this person? And, one of them said yes, and everybody else said no. Our job is to become that person. And that decision that I made in step three has to be matched up by what's in that book. I can't just go on because I'll be like, God wants me to have five wives. God wants me not to go to work on Wednesday because I'm tired. That's the crap I'll come up with, and I'll call it God's will. And I'll convince myself, you'll try to talk me off the ledge, and I already said I don't like 99% of you. Not now. I love you guys now, then. But I'll talk myself into all that crap. I'll make a bad idea sound brilliant. And, somebody in a coma would be like, dude, you're an idiot. But I'll buy into it. So I need that fellowship more and more and more as I go, but it has to be balanced by that relationship with that God. So I did that third step with my sponsor back in Baltimore, and I didn't feel anything. There was no parting of the Red Sea moment. I did that fourth step. I did that fifth step. Once again, no parting of the Red Sea moment. But about a year and a half sober, I realized I hadn't wanted to drink in a while. All my spiritual experiences, all my initial spiritual experiences were in retrospect. Yeah, that happened. I wasn't there at the beginning. And this is why when a man asks me to sponsor him, gives me the privilege of sponsoring them, you're saving my life. You are absolutely saving my life. I have a sponsor. I love him to death. He ain't saving my life. He gives me help with the 11th step. That's the bulk of what we talk about when we talk. We talk a lot about the 11th step. We get outside of the big book for that, and we talk upon, moving beyond spiritual kindergarten. That new person, that grants me the permission to share with them what I've gotten through, because I don't really believe I take you through the steps. I don't really believe I'm putting your hand in the hand of God. If anything, I believe you're going to reveal God's presence to me. And it's infectious. It's intoxicating beyond anything else. When I get that experience, there's also a lot of heartache that goes on with that. I get sick of watching you guys die. I get sick of watching you guys go back to jail, go back to rehab time and time again. I get sick of watching you guys lose your apartments. It sucks. And when I talk to new guys, one of the things that always comes up is it's hard to get sober. And I'm that a-hole that says it's killing me to watch you not get sober. But I wish I had the power. I wish this was like a revival meeting and we could just heal you and you'd move on, and you'd be able to plug in all your life problems to the big book in a flash of an eye. And for some of you, you'll actually get that experience. I didn't, and I get mad at the ones that do. Why? Because I'm lazy. I'm lazy. I don't want to do a 10th step. And if I don't do a 10th step, I'm suffocating. And one of the questions I ask guys that I sponsor that are early on, when we're going through the ninth step, I'll ask him, is when do you think you should be working the tenth step? And, you know, it's amazing that a lot of people think after they do all their amends. I'm like, well, and I did the same thing. Why? Because I'm special. I took a short bus to my spiritual awakening, and it kept breaking down every mile and a half. You don't have to. You don't have to. And that's why I don't sponsor exactly the way my sponsor sponsors. My sponsor was great. He got me into the book. Thank God. Thank God I had a sponsor get me into the book. But my sex conduct inventory was missing in my initial four step. And as, go figure, I had a whole lot of relationship problems. I missed something and I couldn't see it. My 10th step was lacking because I couldn't see it, because I never identified it. I couldn't see what I couldn't see. I don't get mad at the blind man for not being able to cross the street unaided. You know, I couldn't see what I couldn't see. You know, so I had to go back. And in that study of the big book, and in that going to, it was a Joe and Charlie weekend that got me into doing another four step. And I did another four step, and lo and behold, I'm still sick. I've still got problems. I've still got issues. And what I forgot was all that stuff that I did in my initial four step, I'm supposed to be doing on a regular basis. You know, the first thing I should be doing when I feel out of sorts is looking at what's wrong within me, not you. You know, but it's hard because, once again, go back to having that child. You know, when you experience so much, and that love is genuine and it's pure and it's great and it's wonderful, but it puts blinders on you. It puts blinders on you. That child turns into a teenager and starts doing crap you did as a teenager. And somebody else's parent don't feel too great about it. And they say stuff to you about it. And you're thinking, where's my gun? Don't talk about my kid like that. Don't you say that. Yeah. And we do the same thing with our groups, with our home groups. You ever get anybody like, yo, man, don't be talking about my home group like that. We get all gangster on each other in AA. Get real. Come on. You know? If somebody tells me, like, hey, you know what? I don't really like the way you guys run your group. Yeah, okay. Maybe our group needs to do an inventory and look at what are we doing. You know, because one of the things that we're supposed to be doing is being of maximum service. Not target audience. Maximum service. You know, and that ability only comes about through regular use of inventory. I have to continue to take personal inventory. My 10th step is very simple. You know, I have four directions. You know, when these crop up, all those things that I identified in my four step, when these crop up, I asked God at once to remove them. Now, I had to start developing a relationship with God. And AA is so forgiving. We lower the bar so much that even in the chapter Working with Others, which is the instructions for us to carry the message, it tells us to make it emphatic to you that you don't have to buy into our conception of God. Your conception, as long as it works for you, is enough. And it tells you in the chapter We Agnostics on page 46 or something that, much to our relief, we found that we did not have to accept another's conception. Our own, and it does go out to say, our own, no matter how inadequate, was enough. That lowers the bar. There's no excuse for us not to do that. So I had to develop that relationship with God. And you know, I've been lazy about it over the years. And my own personal struggles have been the fuel that have gotten me to try to build that relationship with God. You know what my 10th step, so I have to ask him first. That's the first thing I have to do. And I'm given a second direction, and we talk about clear-cut directions in the book. And you can check all this. It's on like page 84. We ask him at once to remove them. We discuss them with someone immediately. We make amends if we have to. Then we turn our minds and hearts to someone we can help. Love and tolerance of others is our code. I was pretty good at half-assed doing one and four, but I missed the other two. And they're right in there. It's so simple, only an alcoholic could miss it. You know, it's right there in black and white. You don't even have to, like, read your book under a black light with lemon juice to see the secret code. That's some old 70s stuff, man. Some of you guys don't know that. You don't have to do any of that. Like, it's right there in black and white. That's pretty practical. Who can't do that? Who can't go, you know, man, I'm feeling a little resentful. God, help me to not be resentful. Yo, Dave, and I'm feeling a little resentful right now. Yeah, I yelled at that guy at the Wawa. I better stop by there and you know, make amends to him on my way home. You know, and then I need to find somebody I can help. You know, and that becomes a trap in itself sometimes too, because I'll turn the healthiest directions into a recipe for batshit crazy. Because I'll help you to death. I've done it, man. I've been that guy, and I don't do it anymore. But I've been that guy, like, you know, when Carrying the Message Goes Wrong by Steve Kolderbank, you know, I'm going to get you sober, even if we got to fight about it. You know? Like, you're missing a few bits of the program if you're throwing down with your sponsees. And I'm getting too old for that crap, so I've got to get some spiritual. Because I've lived 46 years with all my original teeth, and I intend for nature and bad dental practices to remove them, not somebody's fist. Yeah. So that was kind of a rant off to the side. Sponsorship, as I said, you know, you guys that give us the opportunity to share with you what we've been given are absolutely saving our lives. Because here's the sponsor curse. You're going to call us up, and you're going to be like, yo, man, this is going on. And we're probably, if we're big book savvy, we're probably going to be able to put you right in the book. Somewhere between 2 weeks and a year down the road, probably before we forget, we're going to have a similar problem. And we're going to be confused about it until we run into you again and you're practicing what we suggested to you. You know, and we're going to be like, oh, yeah, I better do what I said that you should do because it looks like it's working for you. At least that's my curse. You know, so the guys that sponsor me that don't ever utilize me, I don't get that benefit from them. I mean, the title of sponsorship is cool. The verb of sponsorship is essential for my recovery. I need to be engaged in it. And sponsorship in AA is really mentorship. And you know, some of the guys I sponsor, all I've got to do, you know, it's not always about the step itself. It's not always about that. Sometimes it's providing opportunities for you to carry the message. These guys were talking about institution commitments, you know, talking about setting up meetings, talking about getting together outside of AA to carry the message to folks that need it. Because all of our affairs, you know, if I walk away from this meeting and I just go on and, like, do, you know, business as usual, which is, you know, default mode a-hole or default mode selfish jackass, any of those that plug in that are my wonderful and colorful defects of character, then I'm not really living a spiritual life. And if I'm willing to help you but I'm not willing to help you, I'm not spiritual. Now, I also got to balance that, you know, and when somebody comes up to ask me to be their sponsor today, especially recently, I've been sponsoring a lot of guys, and I had to say no sometimes because I also have to realize that, I can't be of maximum service if I'm spreading myself too thin. You know, I can't allow my own cup to become empty. And you know, I'd like to, in the last couple minutes, I'd like to talk about that, all of our affairs. You know, the life that I've been able to live because of these 12 steps, these 12 simple steps. I'm pretty freaking stupid when it comes to spiritual stuff. I'm about as, like, dumb as they get. And I found a way through it because other people shared with me what they did. And all I had to do was follow. So all I had to do was be willing to follow. I've had the opportunity to take several atheists through the steps. They said they were atheists. And because I didn't try to determine how they're going to do their step 3 every single one of the guys that I sponsored that called themselves atheists found God in step 9. One guy simply said, when we were talking about his step 3, said that, you know, Steve, my plan ain't working. My life sucks. And I keep ending up feeling empty inside. I'm going to follow you. And we went through and we did his 4th step. We did his 5th step. When he started to go make amends, he started to question me about God. And what I did is when I enter into a sponsor-sponsee relationship, I'll tell you I'm going to think about it. I said, let me think about it for a day. And what I do is I go home and I pray. And I ask God to guide me. Ask the God of my understanding to guide me through there, which is another reason why I can't sponsor everybody the way my sponsor sponsored me. Because he was sponsoring me, I believe, the way his God was telling him to sponsor me. You know, I have to be a channel of that God's peace. You know, my 11th step tells me that I have to strive for those sort of things. It also warns me against, a couple things, falling off into morbid reflection and, wishful thinking, which is where, once again, I need that fellowship to keep me grounded. I need you guys. You know, I want my head up in the clouds, but I need to have my feet down here with you, because this is where the work is to be done. And if I'm just off doing my own thing, calling it God's will, I'll probably never see you guys again. And, of all the wonderful things that have happened in my life, none of them are possible if I didn't come in here and surrender to this way of life. You know, and I owe that to you guys. And what keeps me here, because time away from a drink does not equal mental health. Time away from a drink does not equal anything. The only thing that keeps me balanced and keeps me grounded in earth is getting to share the gift that I was given to you. So really, in a nice way, what I'm telling you guys that are sitting on the fence is you're being really freaking selfish by not allowing us to share the gift with you. You know, if you've got a sponsor and you're not calling that sponsor, if you're hanging out on the outer circle and you're like, yeah, I want to do what those guys are doing, but I don't want to bother them, you're being selfish, because my life depends on it. Because I've proven, I've been locked up with years of sobriety because I stopped helping people. I get really sick when I stop helping people. I can pray all day. That chapter 7 tells me in the opening paragraph that the only thing that will so much ensure immunity from picking up a drink is intensive work with other alcoholics. It works when all else fails. That's paraphrased. It's pretty close. Yeah. So we need you. When we say things like get with somebody after the meeting, you know, we can't always tell what's going on, because a lot of you are like me. Like, I could put on a poker face pretty well for an hour. And I did it for years in AA. I put on my AA face because, you know, if you say something's wrong, somebody might try to offer you a solution. And we're not having any of that. I'll figure it out for myself. You know, just get me a Pepsi. I'll figure it out all by myself. You know, it don't work. It doesn't work. And when you allow us to offer up to you what we've been given, you allow my kid to have a more sane home. You allow my family they're less likely to have a rageaholic in their house. I've replaced a lot of drywall in my home in AA, in sobriety. I drive slow cars now, because the last really cool car I had, I nearly lost my license in sobriety. I think I'm mature enough to handle one now, but we're waiting a little bit for that to happen, because I'm not quite there yet. My life is in your hands, because you're going to reveal God to me. You know, I'll leave you with this. A couple years ago, my daughter came to live with me, and I got married in AA and got divorced in AA, and that's an awesome spiritual rectal exam if you ever want to experience it. It really sucks. And like all divorces, it was bad on both parts. It wasn't bad on one person's part. But when my daughter came to live with me, she said, Dad, This is the only place I don't have to choose who I love more. You can't give me a better gift than that. Because all I did was practice spiritual principles on a semi-daily basis. I can tell you that since 13 years sober to now, I pretty much have been regular in my spiritual maintenance. You know, so God's grace goes a long way. I don't know if it goes further than 13 years, but at 13 years I had a spiritual awakening of a very different kind that I didn't really hit on the night, but I must not have been meant to. So I'm done. We've got a minute left, and I'll turn it back over to Lauren.